Today is Monday, February 15th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedwofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, lawmakers grapple with fallout from trial of former President Trump.
Some lawmakers, including a few in Trump's Republican Party, have suggested he may face other consequences.
Also ahead, President Biden calls for tougher gun laws.
President Biden is calling on Congress to require background checks on all gun sales and ban assault weapons.
Plus, anti-coup protests continue in Myanmar. These stories and more are next. Lawmakers in Washington are grappling with the fallout from the impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump, who was acquitted in the Senate, and how to move the country forward. VOA's Michelle Quinn reports.
And he is hereby acquitted.
With the trial of Donald Trump over, after the Senate acquitted the former president for his alleged role in the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, there are questions as to what happens next. Some lawmakers, including a few in Trump's Republican Party, have suggested he may face other consequences.
President Trump is still liable for everything he did while he was in office as an ordinary citizen. Unless the statute of limitations is run, still liable for everything he did while he's in office. Didn't get away with anything yet.
But what might those consequences be? Trump still has enormous power within the Republican Party. After the trial's verdict, Trump released a statement suggesting his political movement has only just begun. Yet some Republicans, including Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy, who voted to convict the former president, says it is time for the party to move on from Trump.
I think as force wanes, the Republican Party is more than just one person. The Republican Party is about ideas.
Some lawmakers are calling for a commission to further investigate and understand what led up to the attack on the Capitol, much like the so-called 9/11 Commission that investigated the 2001 terrorist attack on the United States.
There's still more evidence that the American people need and deserve to hear, and a 9/11 commission is a way to make sure that we secure the Capitol going forward and that we lay bare the record of just how responsible and how abjectly violating of his constitutional oath President Trump really was.
Senate lawmakers voted 57-43 to convict, coming up shy of the 67 votes needed to do so. The vote comes a month after the House of Representatives impeached Trump in the case. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
Saturday's vote at the Senate impeachment trial of former U.S. President Donald Trump took place after 4 days of hearing from lawyers for the House of Representatives who prosecuted the case against him and lawyers who defended him. VOA Steve Reddish examines how politics shaped the strategies behind both sides' arguments.
And he is hereby acquitted of the charge in said article.
Impeachment managers won the argument, but they lost the war. Saturday's 57-43 decision in the Senate was 10 votes short of convicting former President Donald Trump of inciting the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. In an evenly divided Senate, finding 17 Republicans to vote with all the Democrats to convict was a daunting task.
The last impeachment was the first time any person had crossed the aisle to vote for an impeachment of someone from their party. This time, seven did. I think there were at least two more votes that were left out there because of how this was brought to the Senate.
Sarah Isker is a staff writer for The Dispatch, a conservative media group, and was the top spokeswoman for U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions. She says the Democrats may have drawn more votes with a bipartisan approach.
I think that the House managers could have strengthened their case by involving Republicans, both in the drafting of the article of impeachment, which I think Republican involvement would have narrowed that, really just to the dereliction of duty argument. What happens after rioters storm the Capitol on January 6th, and what actions or inactions does the president take on that day, rather than the incitement argument, which is so broad?
Heidi Katrozer is a constitutional law professor at the University of Minnesota. She says the Democrats made an effective case.
And what I was particularly impressed by was how they created a long timeline showing weeks of buildup. And then the timeline even after the attack, sort of pointing out the way in which the lack of response, the indifference, et cetera, was also indicative of this apparent intent and pleasure with the what he had incited.
Lawyers for Trump came to the case late after the previous attorneys were fired. Again, Heidi Kittroser.
They seem to spend a lot of time blaming the House managers for not telling them what the president thought, what the president knew when he knew it, when that is, of course, their own client.
Again, Sarah Isker.
And it's pretty clear that Trump's team did not think there was a chance the Democrats could get to 67 votes for conviction. And so then, again, you look at what their metric of success is. They believed that there was nothing they could do or say to get their client convicted.
Isker contends Democrats also did not believe they could get to the 67-vote threshold.
And I think in that case, A, their audience becomes immediately the American public, and B, their metric of success most likely becomes the next election.
Time to cue campaign 2022, when elections to fill House and Senate seats next take place. Steve Reddish, VOA News, Washington.
Sunday marked the 3-year anniversary of the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. And it's also a day when President Biden is calling for tougher gun laws. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
In nearby Fort Lauderdale, the city held a ceremony where the names of the 17 students and staff killed by a former student were read. Another ceremony is taking place in Parkland. President Biden is calling on Congress to require background checks on all gun sales and ban assault weapons. In a statement, he said, "We owe it to all those we've lost and to all those left behind to grieve, to make a change. The time to act is now." The governor ordered flags to be lowered to half staff and everyone in the state to pause for a moment of silence at 3 p.m. I'm Julie Walker.
Security forces in Myanmar have intensified their crackdown against anti-coup protesters seeking to quell the large-scale demonstrations calling for the military junta that seized power earlier this month to reinstate the elected government. But vast numbers of demonstrators defied orders against protests and took to the streets of Myanmar once more to march against the coup that ousted the elected government of Aung San Suu Kyi. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
Large demonstrations were held in the major cities of Yangon, Mandalay, and the capital Naypyidaw, as well as in far-flung areas dominated by ethnic minorities. Protesters in Yangon again rallied outside the Chinese and U.S. embassies. They accused Beijing of propping up the military regime and applaud Washington's actions sanctioning the military. Resistance also took place in cyberspace as hackers defaced the government's news website, replacing its homepage with words and pictures against the military takeover. The activism took place after the ruling junta issued a new order suspending several basic civil liberties. The recent order allows authorities to carry out searches and make arrests without court warrants and permits the detention of detainees for more than 24 hours without court permission. I'm Karen Chamas.
At least 60 people were injured as hundreds of fuel vehicles exploded in a massive blaze that tore through a customs post in Afghanistan close to the Iranian border. Saturday's fire disrupted power supplies and caused millions of dollars of damage. Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters reports.
Hundreds of fuel vehicles exploded close to Afghanistan's border with Iran on Saturday, injuring dozens of people. The fire tore through a customs post in the border town of Islam Khala, disrupting power supplies and causing millions of dollars of damage. Video obtained by Reuters showed thick plumes of black smoke rising into the air. Iranian authorities sent ambulances and fire engines across the border to help tackle the blaze, which as of Saturday evening had reportedly been brought under control. NATO-led personnel in Afghanistan were also asked to help contain the fire. A Western official monitoring the situation told Reuters at least 60 people had been injured. Afghan officials gave a lower casualty toll, but said that number could rise. Iranian state media reported that about 500 vehicles had been burnt. Officials said the cause of the fire was not immediately clear. Initial reports suggested the blaze started after a gas tanker exploded.
That's Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has announced the city of Auckland began a 3-day lockdown on Sunday after New Zealand recorded its first cases of COVID-19 since late January. Adam Reid of Reuters reports.
New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern on Sunday announced a three-day lockdown in the country's biggest city, Auckland, after three new COVID-19 cases emerged. They're the first local infections detected since late January. Ardern said level three restrictions will require everyone to stay at home except for essential shopping and essential work.
3 days, though, should give us enough time to gather further information, undertake large-scale testing, and establish if there has been wider community transmission. That is what we believe the cautious approach requires and is the right thing to do.
She went on to tell the news conference in Wellington, quote, "We've stamped out this virus before and we will do it again." Sunday's cases were traced back to a couple and their daughter in Auckland. Health authorities are trying to find out whether they involve any of the new highly infectious variants that have been found in other countries, including the UK and South Africa. The COVID-19 alert for the rest of New Zealand was raised to level two, with all gatherings limited to 100 people, including at restaurants and cafes. The country is due to start inoculating its population of 5 million with the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine from next Saturday.
That's Adam Reed of Reuters. This is the Voice of America. 164 countries of the World Trade Organization on Monday approved Nigeria's Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala as the body's new head. She is the first woman and the first African to lead a Geneva-based organization. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration endorsed her after the Trump administration had opposed her. Supporting her is part of Biden's vow to re-engage in multilateral organizations instead of Trump's America-first approach. But there are still thorny disputes to resolve. That's especially true when it comes to the WTO's appeals process, where the U.S. has said the WTO unduly restricts U.S. trade measures against other countries pursuing an unfair trade. Health authorities in Guinea and international health partners have pledged immediate action to stop the spread of the Ebola virus that was identified in Zereko region this weekend, the same place where a previous outbreak started in 2013. The West African nation on Sunday confirmed that at least three people have died from Ebola there, the first cases confirmed since it was one of three West African nations to fight the world's deadliest Ebola epidemic that ended 5 years ago. A Philippine official says President Rodrigo Duterte's administration wants considerable more U.S. military aid in exchange for not exiting a security pact with Washington.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to the American Heart Association, the health term heart failure doesn't mean a person's heart has completely stopped working, but that a patient's heart isn't pumping as well as it should be. They add, if the heart isn't pumping properly, the body's cells can't be sufficiently nourished to ensure a properly functioning body. A new study in the European Journal of Preventive Cardiology finds that globally, the number of heart failure patients almost doubled from 33.5 million in 1990 to 64.3 million in 2017. To reach their findings, researchers analyzed data gathered in a study that included patients in 195 nations. The study found while heart failure rates dropped in more developed countries over the span of the study, they increased in less developed nations. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The World Health Organization says debilitating post-COVID-19 symptoms in patients will have an impact on global health because of the magnitude of the pandemic. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The World Health Organization is conducting research into why many people who are infected with COVID-19 continue to suffer from various disabling conditions for up to 6 months after they have had the illness. The team lead of WHO's Healthcare Readiness Division, Janet Diaz, says some people with post-COVID-19 conditions, also known as long COVID, have not been able to go back to work. She says their incapacitating symptoms prolong their recovery period.
Some of the more common symptoms of the post-COVID-19 condition can be fatigue, post-exertional malaise, and cognitive dysfunction. And sometimes you may be hearing patients describe that as brain fog. These are real.
Other complications include shortness of breath, cough, and mental health and neurological complications. Diaz says it is not clear which patients are most at risk of long COVID. She says they range from patients who have been hospitalized and required intensive care treatment to those with mild illnesses who were treated in ambulatory outpatient settings. She says researchers do not know why this is happening and are working hard to get the answers to the many questions surrounding this disease caused by the SARS-CoV-2 virus.
We are concerned, obviously, with the numbers of patients infected with SARS-CoV-2 virus. We don't know how common it is or how uncommon it is, but the numbers, just by the magnitude of the pandemic, will impact health systems. Again, the main message from us is prevent infection with SARS-CoV-2. So the public health measures are the number one interventions right now that we know will prevent this.
These measures include observing physical distancing, wearing a mask, and hand washing. WHO is calling for a coordinated global research response and the collection of as much standardized clinical data as possible to better understand the condition and learn how to better treat those afflicted with this complication. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
COVID-19 vaccine rollouts have come with mixed but increasing success in developed countries with functional infrastructure. Delivering life-saving medicine to those in the remotest locations remain a challenge. VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports on a German startup looking to change that.
Flying over Ireland is a drone that may one day help in saving countless lives in remote parts of our planet. Wingcopter CEO Tom Plumer says the machinery and mission come together further east at this facility in Weitershausen, Germany.
It's a unique drone with extreme efficiency. That's the one thing, though, on the technology side. On the other side, we had the idea to use the drone technology to deliver medicals or medication or any kinds of medical products faster.
Plumer says he wanted to improve supply chains after spending 2 years in West Africa and seeing how even small disruptions could create major issues. So he worked to develop a drone that could deliver medical supplies to the farthest corners of the world, even partnering with organizations like UNICEF and conducting test flights in extreme conditions.
The drone is able to work in very strong cold temperatures, even to very hot temperatures, as well as strong winds. So our tiltrotor technology, which is the unique piece of the drone to enable these hovering, vertical takeoff, and long-range flight, this technology enables to fly in nearly every circumstance and surrounding or location in the world.
Plumer says Wingcopter is in talks with ministries of health and logistic partners in various countries. The company is currently looking to deliver COVID-19 vaccines in Southeast Asia as well as parts of Africa. Both, Plumer says, are building blocks toward a global solution for faster vaccine delivery. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
India's nationwide vaccination drive against COVID-19 is picking up speed after encountering, quote, vaccine hesitancy, unquote, in a country where the pandemic has waned. Reporter Anjana Patricia visited an inoculation center in New Delhi Hospital to see the hurdles and the progress in India's drive, which it has built as the world's largest.
A sense of apprehension, then a sense of relief, as these health workers at Indraprastha Apollo Hospital in New Delhi received their first vaccine shot against COVID-19.
I heard from so many people that there is lots of side effects, but actually I was a bit worried before I received the vaccine, but I feel good and I'm waiting for the next dose.
I feel very safe because I worked for a long time in a COVID ward. Even if something has happened to me, I will be all right with this vaccine.
After the inoculation, the health workers click photos at a selfie point. Such initiatives are part of a massive drive by officials to persuade people to take the shot in a country battling to overcome vaccine hesitancy. After India rolled out its nationwide vaccination program a month ago, initial reports about possible side effects of vaccines raised doubts among some, even health workers. To ease such worries, doctors are stepping forward to get inoculated.
people were a bit scared, a lot of questions. We kept on answering their questions. And then when they saw that vaccine is quite safe, this helped us in building the confidence in vaccine.
The pace is picking up. Daily numbers of inoculations at this center have increased threefold. That is not the case in some other vaccination centers. The problem is a decreased sense of urgency about getting inoculated as India's case numbers dip dramatically. Markets are buzzing. There are lines outside metro stations. Some are also hesitant to take one of the two vaccines India is using because final trials have not concluded. However, health officials are trying to reinforce the message that only vaccinations will end the pandemic.
The centers where it is not good footfall, there we are a bit too worried. There we are using mobilizers, senior consultants. We are calling them up to see that they get that vaccinated.
The next phase, inoculating those over 50, may pose greater challenges. Even this vulnerable group is divided about taking the shots.
Whenever my turn comes, I will take the vaccination.
Personally, I'll wait and watch because I feel my immunity is okay.
So far, more than 8 million people have been vaccinated. But those numbers will have to be scaled up substantially if India is to meet its target of reaching 300 million people by August. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Japanese officials warned of aftershocks on Sunday following a strong earthquake in the Fukushima region that left over 100 people injured and many homes without water. Here again is Adam Reed of Reuters.
The magnitude 7.3 tremor struck just before midnight on Saturday in Japan's Fukushima region, which was also hit nearly 10 years ago, setting off a deadly tsunami. Saturday's quake cracked walls, shattered windows, and set off a landslide close to the epicenter. National television said 104 people were injured, but that there were no reports of any deaths. Hundreds of thousands of buildings reported temporary power losses. Most supplies have since been restored, but many homes remain without water. Trains were halted over huge areas of northeastern Japan on Sunday. Buildings also shook in the Japanese capital of Tokyo, located hundreds of miles away. No irregularities were reported at any nuclear facilities, and the earthquake appears not to have caused a repeat of the 2011 tsunami, which devastated the Pacific coastline and killed nearly 20,000 people. But the Japan Meteorological Agency still issued a warning of aftershocks in the coming days.
That's Adam Reed of Reuters. Families of those died or missing following last Sunday's flash flood in the Himalayas have been helicoptered to the location to say their goodbyes. Reuters' Emma McCarthy reports.
For 3 days, Sushama Rana waited at a makeshift dirt helipad in the Indian Himalayas to return to her village and look for her missing brother-in-law. Yashpal Rana was herding goats when a flash flood swept down a remote valley on Sunday, smashing everything in its path.
I hope that his body is found somewhere, whether it is buried or washed away. We expect from the rescuers that those buried will be found soon.
An 8-seater helicopter, more often used to carry tourists, has begun ferrying supplies to the villages, some of which are suffering from power and water cuts. Authorities have transported more than 300 people since the disaster, but the list of people wanting to ride is long. Meantime, rescuers used heavy machinery to remove slush clogging a tunnel on Friday in a search for more survivors, though hopes of finding anyone alive were fading. Soldiers deployed to the area have flown a drone inside the tunnel to take pictures and try to drill a path into it, but made little headway. So far, there have been no signs of life.
That's Imam McCarthy of Reuters. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.